She had only taken her eyes off the herd for a moment. A buzzard, circling above her in the deep blue sky, was looking for an incautious weasel or a particularly tasty insect, and it enraptured her. She loved buzzards. Several feathers adorned her white felt hat, and she was just thinking about how she wanted a few more flyers to spruce things up when she noticed the absent cow, a young steer born the previous spring and the bane of her existence. The animal simply wouldn't stay put with its kin, a dozen or so head of cattle munching contentedly at the grasses growing along the edges of the stream. Even his mother's lowing cries couldn't induce him to stick around. She sighed again, resigned to having to chase the silly little steer out toward the scrubby desert that lay beyond the lake and rivers. Shrugging off her white wool cloak for ease of movement, she soon picked up the steer's trail in the sandy ground. For some reason, the little fellow had a particular affinity for ephedra plants. They were safe for him to eat, unlike pregnant cows, who suffered terrible illness if they so much as looked at ephedra. But it wouldn't do to have the steer wandering off and getting lost in the desert. Water was life, and the desert was death. Her people were always clear on that. She cursed the buzzard and herself for letting the bird distract her. After a few minutes' walk following the tracks, she spotted the wandering steer. Exactly as she expected, it was cropping the scraggly branches of an ephedra plant without a single care in the world. Carefully striding over to the animal so as to avoid spooking it, she managed to work her way around to its side. Using the length of poplar wood she used as a goad, she started to poke and prod the steer back the way they'd come. He looked at her placidly with his big, doleful eyes, and then went back to munching. A firmer whack of the stick finally got him moving, and he trotted off back toward the stream and the rest of the herd. The buzzard, still circling above, suddenly dove groundward. It snatched a lizard from the shade of the nearby ephedra bush on which the steer had been munching a moment ago, then soared back up into the blue. A single feather slowly fluttered to earth. She plucked it from where it landed and stuck it on her hat with the rest, then followed the wayward young animal back to the herd, hoping this would be the last time she would have to trek out into the desert today, and knowing it almost certainly wouldn't be. Hello, my friends, and welcome to another episode of Past Lives. I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks so much for being here today. For tens of thousands of years of human life on this planet, Xinjiang, the sparsely populated northwest region of present-day China, was an abandoned wasteland at the heart of Eurasia. Towering mountains, the Tian Shan, soar more than 20,000 feet into the sky, separating Xinjiang into two equally unwelcoming halves. The Dzungarian Basin, the northern half of Xinjiang, includes the spot on Earth most distant from any ocean. The Altai Mountains of Siberia hem it in on the northern side, with Arctic cold lurking just beyond the ridges and peaks. The rain shadow of the Himalaya Mountains keeps Xinjiang extremely dry. Most of the southern half, the Tarim Basin, is taken up with the Taklamakan Desert, an endless expanse of rolling dunes and dust storms roughly the size of Germany. Few, if given the option, would choose a life in the extreme conditions of Xinjiang. And yet, for most of the past 4,500 years, Xinjiang has been one of the most vital regions on Earth. That's because of its unique geographical position. The most viable east-west routes across the Eurasian continent pass directly through these challenging landscapes, connecting the densely populated river valleys of East Asia, the Yellow and Yangtze, to the steppe of Central Asia and then the Mediterranean beyond. The famous Silk Road, the overland route linking China to the markets of first the Roman and then the Islamic world, traveled along a string of oasis towns and caravanserais that rendered the deserts and mountains passable. All of the most important technological and cultural innovations that have defined life in Eurasia since the Bronze Age have passed through Xinjiang. Millet, wheat, barley, sheep, cattle, the staples of life for billions of people, traveled across the desert and mountains on their way to their eventual destinations. So too did the chariot, camels packed with a king's ransom and trade goods, and the herds of horses that Chinese aristocrats and cavalry soldiers rode. Genghis Khan and Tamerlane used Xinjiang as an invasion route. But since the fall of the last great nomadic empires at the end of the Middle Ages and the emergence of seaborne trade routes, Xinjiang has become a backwater, rarely considered in broader narratives of world history. Thanks to stunning archaeological discoveries and cutting-edge analytical work, that lack of consideration is beginning to change. We now know who the inhabitants of Xinjiang were over those long millennia, how they got there, and how they survived. In today's episode, we'll meet one of Xinjiang's ancient residents, a woman who lived nearly 4,000 years ago. Archaeologists and the general public know her as the Princess of Xiaohe. That name, Princess, isn't because she was buried with stunning riches in a magnificent tomb, but because her striking face, frozen in death, is still so clearly visible to us today. A quick note on sources here. I'm working entirely from papers and journal articles, along with translated news articles covering research originally published in Chinese. Work conducted by Idilisi Abudurusele, Alison Betts, Jinfeng Li, and Gino Caspari was especially illuminating. The Princess of Xiaohe was buried in one of the hundreds of graves that teams of Chinese archaeologists excavated in the early 2000s at an extraordinary site known as Xiaohe Cemetery. Xiaohe, meaning Little River, is located toward the eastern edge of the enormous Taklamakan Desert in the southern half of Xinjiang, known as the Tarim Basin. It sits on top of a large sand dune, with preserved wooden posts sticking up out of the ground marking the locations of graves. Despite the extreme aridity of its immediate surroundings, Xiaohe isn't far from one of the few permanent sources of water in this otherwise arid region, Lop Nur, a surprisingly large saline lake fed by the only two substantial rivers in the Tarim Basin, the Tarim and the Shule. Lop Nur is almost completely dried out today, but for most of the time since the end of the last ice age, it was much larger. At its peak, Lop Nur may have covered nearly 4,000 square miles. In 1928, it still measured nearly 1,200 square miles, but the construction of reservoirs and dams along its two major tributary rivers has led to its near total disappearance in the last century. Lop Nur was an abundant source of life for the kingdoms that dominated this stretch of the Silk Road during the Age of Chinese Empires. Long before that, however, it was the heart of society for the groups that migrated into this region during the early Bronze Age. The Princess of Xiaohe belonged to one of these groups, and she spent her life moving between the water and the sand. Xiaohe Cemetery was first discovered back in the 1930s, during one of the brief periods when Xinjiang was made accessible to outsiders. Locals had known about the site for a while, and the activities of Western explorers in the region had indicated that the outsiders would pay good money for exotic artifacts from lost civilizations. The European visitors noted that the surface was strewn with the remnants of grave robberies. Discarded artifacts, human remains unceremoniously dumped out of their wooden coffins, open pits emptied of their contents. Still, after these early visits, Xiaohe was again abandoned. When a team led by the Xinjiang archaeologist Idris Abdursal, or Idilisi Abudurusele, in this Chinese transliteration, went looking for Xiaohe again in the late 1990s, its location had actually been forgotten, and it took substantial effort to find it again. Once the archaeologists got to work, however, what was left was one of the most intriguing archaeological sites to be systematically investigated in the past several decades. Abudurusele's team discovered and excavated 167 graves over the course of 3 years, and what they found was stunning. Dozens of mummies and hundreds of artifacts belonging to a truly lost society. The Princess of Xiaohe was just one of these individuals, a fantastically preserved window into a world that vanished thousands of years ago. Xiaohe Cemetery is huge. Comprised of hundreds of individual burials, the dune on which it sits is 23 feet tall, 240 feet long, and 130 feet wide. Even without the wooden posts marking the locations of graves, it's easily visible in the surrounding landscape. Those burials fall into five distinct chronological layers, each of which contains at least 10 graves. The tomb robbers who visited the site before its comprehensive excavation only succeeded in damaging 21 graves in the top two layers, leaving nearly 150 of them untouched for archaeologists to investigate in their entirety. Because of the conditions of the Tarim Basin, with its extreme aridity and heat, organic materials that almost always rot away are preserved for millennia in the sand. Wool, wood, animal horn, food items, and human soft tissue all survive at Xiaohe in unprecedented quantities. Among other benefits, the profusion of organic remains allows us to date the site precisely to between 1950 and 1400 BC, the early Bronze Age. After that time, the people who made and used Jiaohe Cemetery for centuries disappeared into the sands of time. Aside from those occasional tomb robbers, the place was forgotten. Thanks to ancient DNA, preserved by the conditions in Xinjiang, along with thousands of years of other archaeological wonders, we can pinpoint where the people buried at Jiaohe came from and what groups they were related to. As it turns out, not one but three distinct archaeological traditions appeared in Xinjiang during the early Bronze Age, after tens of thousands of years of really sparse occupation. The Tian Shan Bailu culture migrated from the east through the Gansu corridor that leads to China's Yellow River Valley. The Chiemu Ercheke, or Chemerchek culture, came from the Altai Mountains and southern Siberia. And the Jiaohe culture, named after this cemetery and the people buried in it, popped up in the Tarim Basin. Each of these three groups was culturally and genetically distinct. The Tian Shan Bailu people were dedicated farmers who made beautiful painted pottery like that found along the Yellow River to the east, and were likely related to the people who had made that. The Chemerchek people had come from the steppe to the north, with a lifestyle based on nomadic pastoralism. Their ancestors were a mixture of migrating herders from the western end of the steppe in present-day Ukraine and western Russia, the Afanasyevo culture, and the indigenous foragers of eastern Eurasia. The Jiaohe were usually assumed to belong in this last category, particularly because of the physical appearance of the mummies, many of whom had red or blonde hair and facial features that later scholars associated with people of European descent. This assumption is massively flawed and ties far too neatly into white supremacist racial ideologies, but ancient DNA has now definitively informed us that the Jiaohe people had nothing to do with those migrating nomadic pastoralists. Their ancestry stemmed not from the Western steppe, but from two distinct indigenous foraging populations that had existed in the vast spaces of Central and Northeast Asia for tens of thousands of years. Their distant ancestors had interbred with the forebears of the indigenous inhabitants of the Americas, and some of them had indeed gone west, where they contributed to the ancestry of those steppe herders who eventually returned to the east around 3000 BC. The ancestors of the Jiaohe, however, never went anywhere else. They made this broad part of Eurasia their home for at least 20,000 years, hunting and gathering in the isolated mountains, river valleys, and forests that ringed the eastern fringe of the steppe. But their world wasn't an unchanging one. When the pioneering pastoralists of the Afanasyevo culture arrived in the eastern steppe just before 3000 BC, the foragers they met, the ancestors of the Jiaohe among them, were happy to adopt pieces of a brand new lifestyle. The princess of Jiaohe lived in a world that had only recently come into being. I went to a museum with my kids a couple of months ago, and my son had a hard time believing that one of the mummies on display had once been a real person. Now, granted, that person had lived about 3,500 years ago, and as I explained to my son, we should expect some deterioration after so much time had passed. While there was still some surviving soft tissue, it didn't really look much like a living, breathing human being. That's actually true of a great many mummies. Most of them bear little resemblance to the fantastically preserved examples that tend to receive the most attention in this day and age, since really any surviving amount of soft tissue is enough for us to call it a mummified set of remains. But that's not the case with a surprising number of the Tarim mummies, the Princess of Jiaohe included. Her face still stares up at us, and it's easy to imagine how she looked in life. High cheekbones, delicate features, long, straight hair flowing down underneath her feathered felt hat. Even her eyelashes are still visible, as if she had just closed her eyes. Coming face to face with the distant past is a rare occurrence, and a powerful one. Nearly 180 burials in total have been discovered at Jiaohe Cemetery, and the one containing the princess goes by the designation M11. The excavators haven't published full descriptions of the vast majority of the graves, even in Chinese, so our grasp of the whole cemetery site is perhaps less comprehensive than we might hope. Still, the princess's grave, M11, is one of the few for which we are lucky enough to have a full description. The graves at Jiaohe fall into two and possibly three burial types. All but a few are of the most common type, which involved placing the deceased in a sealed wooden coffin oriented toward the northeast and buried directly in the sand. A wooden pole was driven into the ground at the head of the coffin to mark the burial spot, and these poles were often, but not always, carved with human-like imagery. Four of the burials, a tiny number, were mostly the same, but had the wooden coffins sealed with clay. Interestingly, all of the sealed coffins belonged to women, perhaps hinting at some special role or status for these outliers. The third type at Zhaohe isn't necessarily a burial at all, but a lone structure on the surface toward the northern end of the cemetery, built using wooden posts, planks, and cattle hide coverings, with a layer of cattle skulls on top. No human remains were found inside, and its function at the site may have been purely ceremonial. The princess's grave falls into that most common category. She was buried in a wooden coffin covered with cowhide. As the cowhide dried out in the arid sand of the Tarim Basin, it contracted, sealing the coffin completely. That's why her features are so extraordinarily well-preserved, even by the standards of other mummies from the region. And it's so easy to picture what she looked like during her life nearly 4,000 years ago. You barely need a facial reconstruction or an artist's rendering to see her as she once was. The princess was young when she died, probably in her late teens or early 20s. A recent demographic analysis of the remains from Zhaohe shows that an early death was common for residents of this harsh region. Women tended to die a bit younger than men, but adults of either sex in what we consider the prime of life were distressingly likely to perish before their time. She was short by our standards, standing 1.52 meters, or just shy of 5 feet tall, a couple of inches smaller than the average height of women buried at Zhaohe Cemetery. Her genetic makeup is typical for the Zhaohe culture, with a mixture of ancient North Eurasian and ancient Northeast Asian ancestry, and a complete absence of gene flow from Indo-European-speaking pastoralists and East Asian farmers alike. When the princess was laid to rest in her coffin, a beautiful hat of white felt, adorned with feathers, covered her long red hair. A tasseled wool cloak, also white, a string skirt, and leather boots lined with fur completed her ensemble, while she wore a necklace of red rope and a bracelet with a single jade bead. We don't know why, but those who buried her covered her body, all the way down to the boots, in a white substance probably derived from dairy products, while chunks of cheese made from a kefir starter were placed next to her head and neck. The samples of cheese found at Zhaohe, not just in the princess's grave, are the oldest ever found by archaeologists. Three small pouches full of ephedra, a potent stimulant used across the world for tens of thousands of years, accompanied her into the coffin, as did twigs from ephedra plants, a few wooden pins, and some kind of phallic wooden object placed on her chest. Unfortunately, if specific, in-depth studies like those carried out on Ötzi and the Ancient One have been done for the princess or any other mummy at Zhaohe, the results haven't been published anywhere I can find them in either English or Chinese. The best we have are overviews of health, diet, and demography for the cemetery as a whole. Yet, while reconstructing her specific experience, her aches and pains, where she grew up and traveled, her cause of death, and so on, is currently beyond our reach, we can say a great deal about the world she lived in, how she lived in that world, and the culture of which she was a part. The Zhaohe culture is unique. It appeared out of nowhere in the eastern Tarim Basin, with sites ringing the now much shrunken lake, Lop Nur, around 2100 BC. There were no earlier antecedents in the region, no obvious processes of development that led to the appearance of cattle-raising, canoe-paddling residents in this region during the early Bronze Age. There wasn't enough wild plant and animal life to sustain a viable foraging society. This part of Xinjiang is hundreds of miles from the most westerly outposts of early farming groups in East Asia. It wasn't until pastoralists originating in the steppe north of the Black Sea began to arrive in the eastern reaches of the grasslands that a solution to these conditions presented itself. That solution, however, was indirect. The Zhaohe people were not descendants of the migrating pastoralists who brought cattle, sheep, and domesticated horses east. They shared zero ancestry with the migrating Afanasievo pastoralists and were instead entirely descended from indigenous hunter-gatherers. Nor was their lifestyle a carbon copy of the pastoralists. They didn't adopt horses, wagons, or pottery, much less the hierarchical, warlike, male-dominated culture that defined the early Indo-Europeans. The Zhaohe were something different. The direct ancestors of the Princess of Zhaohe and the others interred along with her probably lived somewhere in eastern Kazakhstan, the Altai Mountains of southern Siberia, or even the towering Tian Shan at the heart of Xinjiang. At some point, they encountered pastoralists with the full suite of domesticates. Maybe the early Afanasyevo, more likely the later Chemerchek people who adopted the Afanasyevo lifestyle and were partially descended from them. The Chemerchek began moving from the environs of the Altai into northern Xinjiang after 2500 BC. And, somewhere along the way, they encountered the princess's forebears. Those foragers didn't mix with the pastoralists, at least not enough to leave any genetic trace, but they did like their cattle, and somehow acquired them. Trade is one possibility, and theft is another. Whatever the means of acquisition, cattle opened up a variety of new possibilities for the princess's great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents. Maybe they already knew about Lop Nur, this giant, salty lake at the heart of the Tarim Basin, and moved south. It was essentially a gigantic oasis, surrounded by desert poplar trees, bulrushes, reeds, and a variety of shrubs suited to arid and semi-arid environments, ephedra included. There, amid the marshes and small waterways that surrounded Lop Nur, they developed their own distinctive way of life. The precise chronology isn't clear, but the princess probably lived around 1800 BC, around 150 years after the first people were buried at Xiaohe Cemetery. At a rough estimate, 10 generations are all that separate her from her hunter-gatherer ancestors and their acquisition of cattle. In those three centuries, her people adapted to their surroundings and mastered them. Isolated from their neighbors for hundreds of miles on every side, they took their practices and beliefs in idiosyncratic directions. Rather than the full suite of steppe domesticated animals, they relied almost entirely on cattle for meat, hides, and especially dairy products. There was a good reason for this. Cattle, unlike sheep or horses, are well-suited to a wetland environment like that around Lop Nur. Their substantial water requirements are less of an issue than they are out on the dry steppe. They handle soft terrain more easily, and edible grasses abound near the lakeshore. As a result, cattle were the logical choice for specialization. Hides covered the coffins at Xiaohe, were turned into leather clothing, and provided a large proportion of the total calories the princess and her people consumed over the course of their lives. Sheep, which were far more common on the steppe, were mostly valued for their wool, so far as we can tell. As with the princess's garb, the Xiaohe people made colorful, distinctive clothing. Tall felt hats decorated with feathers, flowing cloaks, bright waistcloths, finely crafted leather shoes. Pottery rarely appears at Xiaohe sites. Instead, they made their containers and everyday objects out of the abundant wood and grass that surrounded the water. The Xiaohe people, the princess included, subsisted on cattle products, but supplemented their diet with fish and shellfish from the lake and streams and plants that grew along their banks. The only wild animals that appear at Xiaohe sites are weasels. Domesticated wheat grains have been found at Xiaohe, but these may have been acquired through trade. There's no direct evidence of farming around Lop Nur at this time. The Xiaohe lived on exactly the route at precisely the time that wheat was moving from west to east through the region. The earliest evidence of wheat remains from the Gansu Corridor in western China dates to 2100 BC. The same goes for occasional discoveries of millet, which was domesticated in China millennia earlier and happened to be traveling west at the exact same time that wheat was going east. The Xiaohe people used both wheat and millet to make a kind of porridge, but we don't know whether they were actively cultivating either plant or just occasionally traded for them. Because of the extraordinary preservation of wooden objects at Xiaohe, we can glean some insights into how its people understood the world. Large wooden masks carved in the shape of an exaggerated human face, complete with teeth, boat-shaped wooden coffins, and decorated wooden grave markers speak to a rich cultural life. Some scholars have suggested that the poles are sexual in nature, with those topped with a red phallic symbol representing men and those with a black painted oval representing women. That's less likely than a connection with the water imagery of the coffins, which strongly resemble upturned boats. The black-tipped posts would thus be stylized paddles, the red ones steering poles or mooring posts. It would make sense for people who spent their entire lives around a lake and rivers to understand their journey to the afterlife as a voyage in a boat, something they had surely done hundreds, if not thousands, of times. The deceased would need food for the trip, which explains the inclusion of cheese and perhaps milk or yogurt with the remains. It's less clear why so many enormous cattle skulls with their horns still attached were placed in the graves, but given the centrality of cattle to their diets and daily lives, milking, herding, processing hides and meat, cooking, their inclusion makes sense. All of this allows us to draw a clear picture of the Princess of Zhao He, not just of her face, but what her world and life were really like. She was almost certainly born near and spent her whole life around Lop Nur and the waterways that fed into it. Her days were spent paddling along the salty waters of the lake, gathering reeds for basket weaving. She pressed wool into felt and stitched leather. Milking cows, straining kefir, salting beef, and preparing hide were all regular activities. On a hot day, she sat under the shade of a desert poplar and sipped water from a horn or wooden cup. We can wonder if she knew that the millet and wheat that she sometimes consumed as porridge had originated so far to the east and west of her isolated oasis home. So much about her world is lost. The meaning of those wooden masks with exaggerated features, long noses, and enormous ivory teeth, for example. But we know that she lived in a vibrant, unique little world centered around Lop Nur. It hadn't existed a few hundred years before. Within a few more centuries, it would be integrated in every sense to the larger cultural and political forces that made Xinjiang ever more important as the Bronze Age gave way to the Iron. New people moved in, and the Zhao He disappeared into the larger currents sweeping across Eurasia. Xinjiang was becoming the epicenter of an increasingly integrated continent. Their little pocket of genetic and cultural idiosyncrasy was subsumed. But it existed. It was real. And it was the only world the Princess of Zhao He ever knew. Next time on Past Lives, we'll move a good ways to the west, to the place we all think of when it comes to mummies, the ancient Egypt of the pharaohs. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure to subscribe to our Patreon. It's linked in the description here. The Patreon is only $7 a month, and you get tons of great bonus content like Q&As, interviews, and much more. It's thanks to subscribers like you that we can make this show. If you're already a subscriber, you rule, and thanks so much. If you haven't already checked out my new book, Lost Worlds, you should. It's all about prehistory and what we can learn from the distant past. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. The story editor is Rachel Cambori. This has been Past Lives.